Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Mystery to Me podcast. I'm Anya Kane.
And I'm Kevin Greenlee.
And we love movies and television shows with a whiff of mystery. Mystery to Me will feature us riffing on murder mysteries, film noir, cozy detective stories, police procedurals, psychological thrillers, legal dramas, tales of teen sleuths, and more.
Once we're done yucking it up about whatever we've just seen, we'll serve up our five-star final takes on whether it's worth your time.
If you're offended by silliness, profanity, political asides, canine-related interruptions, and losers laughing at their own bad jokes, beware. Also note that some of the stories we'll be talking about are pretty dark, and in some cases, exceptionally badly written. So content warning for murder, violence, suicide, torture, rape, racism, misogyny, homophobia, transphobia, and bigotry.
If there's a movie or show you'd like for us to talk about, email us at mysterytomepodcast@gmail.com. Our show's take on genre is pretty loosey-goosey, so as long as your suggestion has some dash of mystery, we're interested in hearing about it.
Spoiler alert! We're going to be discussing the entirety of this show or movie, spoilers and all. So if you want to be surprised, press pause, go watch the thing, then join us for the show. Now that you've heard our spiel, go ahead and polish off those magnifying glasses and slip into your favorite trench coat. Let's get mysterious. So, Kevin, what did we watch?
We watched The FBI Story, a 1959 movie starring Jimmy Stewart and directed by Mervyn LeRoy and based on the classic book by Don Whitehead, which may not be all that classic. And the movie was produced under the supervision of J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI. So, you know, it's got to be good.
So, did we just watch two... five, six, whoever knows how long, hours of just straight up propaganda, basically?
We watched about 12 hours straight of propaganda, all about how wonderful the FBI is, and how dedicated their agents are. And also, you know, frankly, they told us the definition of murder.
This movie was about the life of an FBI man, a G-man, if you will, but it felt like it lasted a lifetime for us viewers as well. I feel like I lived, got married, had kids, died, got reborn. Like several, this movie goes on forever is what I'm trying to say.
Isn't it like 2.5 hours?
It's 2.5 hours. It's 2.5 hours. It's 2.5 hours. And I just feel like J. Edgar Hoover, you know, the father of the FBI in many ways, just created this weird little grocery list of all the things he wanted in a movie that he would sign off on. And they just gave him everything he wanted, like a spoiled child on Christmas morning. And that was not to the betterment of this film, as you could imagine. I want a plane bomb, then I want a bank robbery, then I want a dead guy, then I want a dead guy's kid. Da-da-da-da-da. Anyways, I'm already getting crazy.
Well, you know, and in fairness, the way you've just described it, a movie with a plane bomb and a bank robbery, that sounds pretty exciting.
Yeah, everyone's mouths watering, they're rubbing their hands together. Ooh.
Listen, what's wrong with you, Anya? You're upset that the movie has interesting elements? Are you some sort of mad woman?
Trust me, all those elements are rendered completely boring by poor storytelling techniques. But
there's also the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah, the KKK is in this. Commies are in it. There's a lot going on here.
South American action.
And oh, Jesus Christ. That was perhaps the most offensive part of the film for me. I'll say this. My thesis is that the FBI story has a really good, interesting movie inside it. But that's not the movie we saw. And I think as we talk about it and take you through it, you'll be able to unpeel this story for yourself and maybe see where some things went wrong and some things could have, with better direction, better storytelling, gone right. Because while I was watching this movie, I was really enjoying parts of it. I was really enjoying parts of it. I was connecting with parts of it. And, you know, I think before we get started,
I appreciated the opportunity the movie gave me to catch up on Facebook, catch up on my texts, my personal correspondence.
Kevin filed his taxes for the next year already. He was vacuuming and watching at the same time. He was getting all sorts of things done. No, I mean, Kevin watched this previously, okay, without me, rude of him, before he met me.
You were furious about it.
I was pretty hurt, but he watched this and he kind of came back to me being like, yeah, it's not perfect. It's a flawed film. It's kind of weirdly serialized and episodic for a feature length film, but you know, it's good. And you know why the reason he thought that is, right?
I'm dumb.
No, you're not dumb. No, you're an intelligent gentleman, but you watched it, as you revealed later, in 20-minute increments for like a week.
Yeah, I had a situation where I had like 20 minutes for lunch, and so I'd make a sandwich. I'd watch 20 minutes of this picture. And this movie is very episodic. And if you watch it spread out, I think it's possible to enjoy it and not to notice some of the mind-numbing repetition.
Yeah, it's almost like a TV show that thought it was a movie. And yeah. What works in a TV show, as you can imagine, is very different than what works in a movie.
And speaking of that, one of the writers of the screenplay was Richard Breen, who was best known for his collaborations with Jack Webb on Dragnet and Pat Novak.
When you said that this was written by Jack Webb's friend, everything clicked for me. It all made sense all of a sudden. It all made sense. The simpering devotion to portraying cops, not only in a positive light, because this goes beyond that. This is in like a pandering, these are the most wholesome men you could ever dream of light. And that's something that happens in Dragnet sometimes in a different way. But in this, it just got cloying after a while. It was like, okay, we get it. Beatify him already. He's canonized. This man is a saint. But the more you tell your audience how wonderful the main character is, the more they're going to probably be like, oh, this fucking guy. Nobody likes that. Nobody likes the teacher bringing the kid to the head of the class and being like, you guys should all be more like Jimmy Stewart. You know, because that just makes, you want to see a character struggle with stuff. You don't want to see them just get patted on the back by the movie every 5 minutes.
Are you going to start talking about Joseph Campbell and the hero's journey?
No, I'm not going to do that. I'm just saying that I want to see the characters I always like are the people who are like, you know, really trying hard and have good qualities, but, you know, are not getting everything like.
Your Luke Skywalker types.
I don't even know what to compare this to. And before we get going, I will say I love Jimmy Stewart. He's great in a lot of stuff. In this, they over Jimmy Stewarted Jimmy Stewart. He's constantly.
But you mainly like him for his poetry, right?
Yeah, his beat poetry. He's electric.
He wrote a poem about his dog, which tore my heart out as a child. See, he had a dog that he loved, and then it passed away.
We stand Jimmy Stewart. And we also previously we? On the, I do. You don't?
What did we just do?
I think you were always raving about him on the Jack Benny show.
He was great on the Jack. He played Jack's neighbor on the television program. Basically the same part that Ronald Coleman played on the radio show. He was always aggravated with Jack. I'd put up with Jack being an awful, annoying neighbor. Very funny.
To me, Jimmy Stewart is like a, you know, he's like, it's like salt, right? You know, like if, you know, a little bit of salt goes a long way in your meal. And if he's doing some Jimmy Stewartisms, that's great. But if the whole character is just that constantly in an annoying way, then it's like you've overloaded your dish with salt and then that's all you can taste. And it's like it ruins the dish. And I think that's what happened here. You know, what we previously talked about him on Anatomy of a Murder. I thought he was great in that because you kind of got the Boy Scout vibe, but he's also now a kind of a fallen prosecutor. He's on the defense now. He's ready to kind of tangle with the prosecution using all the old tricks that had been used against him. So he's kind of got like a bit of a smart aleck and a sneaky and kind of a more vicious edge to him there. And that's kind of fun to see him play a little bit against Hype. But here he's so typed down. It's like every Jimmy Stewart cliche you could imagine, and it's way too much, and it's just aggravating. He's basically like a nothingness, just a bumbling goofball who we're supposed to take seriously.
So Anatomy of a Murder, that's like your platonic ideal of what a Jimmy Stewart movie should be.
Yeah, you know, kind of like let him be charming, but don't let him. Don't let him be cloying. When the character's written to be cloying, then that's just a bad combo.
And on the Jack Benny show, he was often allowed to express anger and frustration, which was fun to see.
You know, he expresses anger and frustration in this movie, and it's played for laughs, but it's mostly at his small children.
and sometimes his wife.
So let's get into it. FBI story is basically broken down into different cases that an individual
let's talk about the framework is that Jimmy Stewart in the late 50s is giving a speech at the FBI headquarters about his life and career for some reason. And I mean, if I would hate to get roped into the audience for something like this. I mean, at your workplace, you find out someone's going to be retiring. He's going to give like a 2.5-hour speech about his life and career over the past 35 years. You can say, well, sign me up for that. Are you just going to, like, you know, send a card with like a gift certificate in it to a Target?
I like to think that he'd been, you know, forced to resign a few months earlier, and then he just showed back up and gave this whole rambling speech, and everyone was trying to figure out how to, like, de-escalate the situation and get him the hell out of there.
And the first story he tells, first of all, he begins it by saying, you know, Webster's defines murder as blah, 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 blah. That's worst possible way to begin a story.
That is a high school. I'd give high schoolers some credit. That is a middle school essay tactic opening with a fucking Merriam-Webster's quote. So that's not auspicious here, folks.
But this first story he tells, I think, offers a great example of what's wrong with the movie as a whole. The story is about a man who decides to kill his mother by blowing up a plane that she's on. And so he blows up the plane and his mother and other people die horribly. At which point the FBI comes into the case. And we are given a masturbatory ode to all the scientific work the FBI does to try to solve this case. They're gathering up pieces of the plane. They're analyzing it. They're doing spectrometers and agmometers and this and that. It is all so scientific and so impressive and so modern.
Gizmos and gadgets.
It's dazzling. It's like the magician in his laboratory or words to that effect. And then it's really an ode to scientific detective work. And then he says, oh, by the way, we got the guy because we were surveilling a bunch of people in the neighborhood. So that's like a bit of a downer. Why are you telling us all that scientific stuff if it's completely irrelevant?
Yeah. And it's just the answer to that is because it makes the FBI look momentarily cool. and Hoover wants to put that in the movie. So doesn't matter if it doesn't shore up the story at all. This is also based on a real case. Jack Gilbert Graham did murder his mother in this way, and a lot of people died. But there's something about, like, you know, maybe if you're going to base it on a real case, you could kind of center the focus and the action around what the FBI actually did do to solve it, as opposed to just all the incidental stuff that ended up maybe helping a trial but otherwise not being particularly important.
Yeah. If you're going to break the case by simple surveillance work, let's focus on that story.
Also, I want to point out something very important here that's maybe not clear. Jimmy Stewart is not working this case, from what I can tell. He's not involved at all.
Right.
He's just using this as an example in his opening.
So in his big 2.5-hour speech about his career, his big opening number is a case he's not even involved with.
I should do that. I should give a talk at my workplace in my newsroom and just be like going
open
on.
Open with Watergate?
Yeah, open with Watergate. Yeah, we were all, you know, and then it'd be like, were you alive in the 70s? And I'd be like, whoops, gotta go. I'd run off and my hat would be left spinning in the air. Like, I mean, like, what? That's what makes me think that Jimmy Stewart at the end is a broken man. And he's giving this whole rambling speech and they're like, oh God, fucking ship's drunk again. And he's up there. Can we get him out without it being a whole embarrassing thing? Is he armed? I don't know. Listen, I'm going to give the movie credit where it's due, because I actually did enjoy elements of this strange, strange artifact. My feeling was that elements of the plane explosion were exciting. It's sort of like Hitchcock's rule about, like, you let the audience know there's a bomb and the, you know, the people in the movie don't know there's a bomb, you know, dramatic irony. That was fun.
There was 2 minutes of this movie that were genuinely entertaining.
Yeah, I was like, I think I would say, in fairness, there's more than that. But this one was one where I'm like, I would have loved to, like, see Jimmy Stewart actually investigate this and have a little bit more time with it. But it's just kind of like, it's like you're going on a tour. You're on a tour bus and, you know, Jimmy Stewart's like, oh, see there, that's that. And then, like, that's it. And you're driving on and you're looking at the next thing, which I don't think in most cases is going to be a particularly effective movie, as you can imagine, you know, because none of these things are linked. There's no really thematic arc aside from look at how wonderful the FBI is. But that was one that I did. I liked the suspense there for a minute.
Now, in fairness to the movie, there is another arc, which is look how bad his wife is.
Yeah. Wives, they suck. Skirts, yes. Who needs them? That's what I say. What? You don't like my sexist character?
And we meet his wife here in a minute, because right after he finishes this very dull story about an exciting event, the plane explosion, we go back 30-some years to the mid-20s, where Jimmy Stewart is supposed to be, I guess, in his mid-20s, but he looks exactly the same as he does in the opening of the movie, except his hair has been badly dyed.
Yeah.
But he has all of these wrinkles, and he walks and moves and speaks like an elderly man. And if you saw someone in his 20s walking and moving like this, what would you do?
I'd say, hey, it's Kevin Greenlee.
No. So in other words, you'd be very concerned for him.
I would be concerned for him. And I just, here's my question with this. You know, is it fair to say in movies it's typically easier to make a guy look older than he is with makeup as opposed to younger than he is, or just in general?
I don't know. Bad makeup,
they could have taken a younger guy and dyed his hair, you know, salt and pepper for the older scenes and then have him be young. I think that would have been easier. And in that case, you don't want to cast Jimmy Stewart because he's older at this point. And that's okay. But, like,
I think the original sin of the picture is the decision to cover 30 years in
yes.
one movie.
They could have had Jimmy Stewart. We talked about this after the movie, after we watched it. They could have easily picked one case, told it, had Jimmy Stewart be the older FBI agent who has a lot of experience, and then cast another person if they wanted, like, a young guy to do other things. And then they could have had their stories coexisting as they go for a particularly interesting case in which they have to use the FBI's, you know, multitude of bounty and goods and scientific prowess in order to solve it. Because here's the thing. propaganda is way more effective when you're showing rather than telling how cool your agency is. And when it's just incidental to the plot, but like you're still conveying it in a natural, non-forced way.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
And let me say, the FBI, obviously, we're all adults here. It's not a perfect agency, but in severe problems in the history of the agency. But with that said, they have been involved in a huge number of very interesting cases, including cases where they've done outstanding work. So I think it would be child's play to make a movie about a case the FBI was involved in and did well in and make it interesting.
I really think this movie bears a lot of the hallmarks of like J. Edgar Hoover just being a weirdo, because I really feel like he gave the film producers a list of cases and they were like, oh, cool. So maybe we can pick our top three. And he's like, you're doing all of them. Like, those are all going in the movie. You know, like he's like fast talking them. He apparently talked really fast because he had a stutter or something. And like just, you know, and they're just like, okay, Mr. Hoover, don't publish those photos of a dancing girl that we were with. You know, like it just smacks of like he wanted all of these cases covered and they just went along with it. Because he had to, the legend is, or I don't know how accurate this is, but the legend is that he had to approve every single frame of this film, and that they did reshoots to please him specifically. So he was a huge stakeholder.
Why would they even agree to that?
I don't know why they would agree with it. I mean, because it's not like the access that he's able to give them is that particularly interesting. Frankly, you could have probably, anyone with an imagination and the ability to do a modicum of research could have probably come up with a pretty interesting story that would have been positive for the FBI by themselves. So it's not like, maybe other than like, they got to shoot outside the building or something.
Yeah, while we're on that, there are a lot of scenes shot in or near the building or training grounds where we have really bad actors who I'm going to suspect are actual FBI agents.
Quantico! The boys of Quantico! That's FBI, right?
Yeah, like, discussing training. Like, okay, boys, here is where you point the gun at the target and fire, but be careful. Oh, you hit the wrong target. Okay, now it's time for the next. And this goes on for like, what, a half hour?
Yeah, that scene was basically 20 minutes.
And there's lots of these training scenes which add nothing and are done poorly by non-charismatic performers.
Honestly, this whole thing would have probably been more interesting for me as a documentary. If they just wanted to do a documentary interviewing the actual people who work these cases and then showed some cuts of like training exercises, because then at least the expectation for your level of charisma and acting would have been very low, so you could have gotten some like just informational, you know, stuff out of it, but you wouldn't have been expecting, you know, them to perform necessarily. I feel like that's what they were trying to go for, almost like a documentary style situation. But the blending of like a big Hollywood movie with like kind of this like, you know, intricate, like, let's talk about everything we want to talk about just feels like, you know, it's a bad marriage.
Speaking of bad marriages, so this first flashback is, as I said, I think in the mid-20s, I think probably 1924. I'm playing that day just off the top of my head. Jimmy Stewart is somewhere, I think, in the Midwest, and he learns he's
Tennessee. He's in Tennessee.
Tennessee is part of the Midwest. By the way, you say, what did you say he was?
Tennessee.
You're the only 10 I see.
Oh! Boom, boom, boom. I shot you with my Tommy gun. For being corny.
Anya hates it when you say kind things to her. So if you ever meet her in person, and if you want to make an impression, be really rude and intemperate.
No, you know what you do? You make a 2-hour and 30-minute movie about me, documenting in really boring detail, like any remotely cool thing I was or was not involved in. That's what you do. That's the way to my heart.
That's how I won you.
The Kane story. Now on Amazon Prime.
So he's unhappy there, and he learns he's going to have to go to Washington, D.C. And so then he goes over to the library where he has a girlfriend, and he says, "Girlfriend, we need to get married because I'm going to be transferred soon, and I want you to come with me." And she says, "You're not happy in the FBI. It's a potentially dangerous career. You could do better work in other agencies and other fields, and you can make more money and be happier. I'll marry you if you just leave the FBI." And he agrees to that. But then, after they get married, he goes to D.C., where he learns that some new hotshot has taken over the FBI, some young firecracker by the name of J. Edgar Hoover, who gives a speech saying, "I'm going to make this FBI something special." And Jimmy Stewart says, "Well, I like the sound of that. Maybe I won't quit after all." And so then he goes and he tells his wife this, and she grudgingly accepts his decision to stay in the FBI, even though he's given her his solemn word that he'll leave. And this basically is the same story we see repeated over and over again throughout the picture. They made the decision in this movie to intersperse all of the crime stories with stories of Jimmy Stewart's home life.
Yeah.
And all the stories about his home life are basically his wife being unhappy that he's in the FBI and then accepting it. And then later she's unhappy about it, but she accepts it. But then she's unhappy about it, but she accepts it. But then she's so unhappy, she leaves him. But you know, then she comes back because she accepts it. So they hit that note over and over and over again. They intersperse it, though, for a little bit of variety, of Jimmy Stewart complaining about his children in ways that are meant to be humorous. Like, we've just seen him take down dangerous bank robbers or defeat the Ku Klux Klan, and then the next scene, he's saying, "Oh, my kids took all my tissue paper. Oh, that's not right. They've taken my tissue paper." And I think we're supposed to find this cute, but it's just like, are we supposed to be? He's acting like the tissue paper is just as important as capturing John Dillinger. So there's no real sense of proportion or stakes.
Also, it's not like it's funny. It's not like, oh, like my wacky dad, like a dad character doesn't have to be perfect. But like, we see him hit this note, just like Kevin was saying with the marriage situation repeating itself again and again. In virtually, it feels like every scene with the kids, there's something like that where it's like, oh, who did this? Oh, you know, like where's my slippers? Oh, why are you doing that? And he's just constantly criticizing and yelling at his kids. And it's like, is this meant to be like this man is obviously riddled with anxiety, and he's expressing it by like freaking out at his family constantly for minor incidents, because instead of like, you know, going to fucking therapy because he, you know, is in the FBI and might get killed, this is how he deals with his stress. That's what it felt like. And it was, after a while, it was just grating to watch. And you're just waiting, like, when is your wife going to tell you to settle the fuck down? Like, like, Jesus Christ. And when is she? Oh, I mean, the family was just awful.
It's like he's Michael Scott in The Office, thinking he's funny or cute, and he's not. And it's like all those family scenes come from like another movie entirely different from this one.
An even worse movie.
And then also, as part of this, he'll occasionally, very, very, very rarely, make some small, tiny gesture to one of his children, at which point he'll be lionized as the greatest father in the world. Like, one of his daughters at one point is about to make a speech, and he says, oh, look over there, there's a flower in a vase. I'm gonna take this flower in this vase, and why don't you put it on your shirt? Maybe it'll make you look nice. Oh my God, that's so sweet of you. You care.
Kevin did actually cry during that scene, I'll note. He's crying like a baby.
And then she goes and she gives the speech and she, you know, fucks it up and is sad and runs out crying. And it's like, is Jimmy Stewart telling all the people in the audience about the time his daughter humiliated herself in public?
Let's talk about the humiliating blocking on that scene.
That's all you, babe.
So, I don't know how to say this. This is not PG in the least. The way that scene is shot, when basically the situation is she runs out, the daughter hides in the car. She's crying. She's understandably upset. And Jimmy Stewart comes in the car to comfort her. And let's say the girl, the daughter who's high school age is sitting in maybe like the driver's seat, or at least she's sitting in the seat of the car that's closest to the camera, and he's sitting in the seat furthest away, maybe the passenger seat. And the way that they have him reaching, like, and maybe we're just really perverted, but the way they have him reaching over to like pet her on the, you know, shoulder and stuff and comfort her, it just looks kind of wrong, and she's like crying, and it's not blocked well.
What did you think it looked like?
It looked like they were having sex.
See, that's what Anya thought. I thought it was just a touching scene between a father and a daughter that he was comforting. You were getting all blue.
It was just...
you were like Red Fox over there.
No, I was. Started cracking up when you saw that.
I was crying. I was so touched. You like just dropped the cigarette from your mouth and said, oh, looks like he's having sex with his daughter.
It was a really weirdly blocked scene. There was no reason for it to be filmed that way. I don't know. And here's the thing. If Hoover was supposed to one by one go through each frame to make sure everything was up and up, why the fuck didn't he circle that and say, get Leroy in here? What the fuck is this? Maybe like a listener will watch this and tell us we're nuts, but I thought it looked, for like, it was one of those things where like you're watching and you're like, okay, whatever, this is happening. And then suddenly you're like, wait, what? And then you're like, oh, okay, I guess it's just the angle.
You were suddenly like waving a fan in front of your face, like, oh my.
Oh my God.
Oh, stars and garters.
Well, I'm sorry. You were too busy weeping in my lap to even pay attention at this point, because you were so touched. All those times you fucked up a speech, no one came and comforted you. People just left you in the mud, left you in the dust. Oh, man.
As long as we're talking about the family, should we just finish it up?
Yeah, let's keep talking about the family.
So they also have a son, and his son tells Jimmy Stewart that he wants to join the Marines, and Jimmy Stewart doesn't mention this to his wife, which you were outraged about.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a pretty serious decision. This is taking place during World War II, so the son is going to be, you know, sent off to fight in either the European or the Pacific theater, and that's a big deal, and that seems like a family discussion, because the son is still, he's only 18 at this point, so that seems like a conversation. If a son came to his dad to talk about that, you know, if the parents are co-equals in the family, that seems like a conversation you'd want your wife in as well. Now, in my opinion, he's 18, it's the son's choice, but I just felt the way that Jimmy Stewart kind of hid it from his wife was kind of shitty, because that implies like a lack of respect. I don't know.
So my plan when we have kids is to have like a multi-volume set of things. These are the things we hide from mother.
Can a really dumb picture of me be on the cover of that multi-volume set?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Just looking like a total doofus.
And the bottom of each page be one of those little flip books of you making faces.
Our kids will be like doing like dead drops or something to get communiques to you, you know, without me hearing about it. It's going to be a whole thing. I'm going to be like fucking FBI, like dealing with like espionage rings in my own household. It's going to be like microfilm. I'm going to be intercepting it. What the fuck are these kids doing next?
Frankly, even now, Lanny and I are running some operations that you have no idea what's going on.
I know Lanny's doing the Marines. Thanks for telling me. The doggy Marines. No, Lanny would be on the other side of the, she'd be one of the doggy gangsters. Okay. She'd be like one of those John Dillinger types where she'd be,
like stylish.
Yeah, she'd be stylish. She'd be driving the cars, driving little doggy cars. Thank you, Henry Ford, for making a great dog car.
She'd be carving dog biscuits out of soap to trick the guards.
The pound. Yeah. Public Enemy.
So is it like a dog FBI too?
Yeah, there's
I like to see that movie.
The Fido Bureau of Investigation.
Why didn't they make a movie about that?
I'd watch the hell out of that. What kind of dog would J. Edgar Hoover be?
Like a bulldog?
Yeah, like a little bulldog.
Now, at this point, I feel like we must mention the Space Cannon Patrol Agents, which is a bunch of superhero dogs who patrol space.
Okay.
Each one has amazing powers. Like you have your Husky Tusky, who has the power to grow like a really big tooth. So are there agents like that in the Fido Bureau of Investigation?
Kevin, they're government agents. They're not grow up. They're not superhero dogs. They're just average working public servants putting their lives on the line to protect other dogs against crazy friggin' outlaws like Lanny.
So is like Scooby-Doo involved in this?
Yeah, he's one of their best.
That's quite an indictment, because he doesn't really seem to be cut out for the work.
He's undercover, man. He's undercover with a group of hippies.
Ooh, he's out to infiltrate the counterculture?
Yeah, he's doing, what is it, COINTELPRO?
COINTELPRO?
Yeah, COINTELPRO. Yeah, he's going after the left.
Wow, you're just like blowing my mind.
Yeah,
here.
This is actually blowing my mind too. Now that I think about it, it kind of makes sense.
Laid on me. How does it make sense?
Well, he's always kind of trying to avoid doing anything directly, and that's so as probably to not, like, fuck up a case in court. He's just always, like, you know. But then I guess he's kind of corrupt because he's constantly taking Scooby snacks from them, so that's bribery. So he's like the FBI agent in, like, the Whitey Bulger case.
So are any of the Scooby gang aware of his double role, or is he fooling all of them?
He's fooling them.
So even Shaggy, his best friend.
Yeah. Zoinks.
He must be a real monster.
Jesus, why are we writing this dark Scooby-Doo fan fiction? Tell me,
I've lost all respect for Scooby-Doo.
Your space, yeah.
I held him in the highest possible esteem.
Apparently he's a narc in our thing that we just made up now. Nah, Scooby's cool. Scooby's part of my childhood too, so he's not a narc.
What about Huckleberry Hound? Surely he's a narc.
Surely. Yeah. Oh, he's definitely a narc. Definitely a narc.
Goofy?
No. What would they do with Goofy?
Pluto?
No. I don't think so. Snoopy?
You don't even go there. What about Sandy?
He's an American hero.
What about Sandy, little Orphan Annie's dog?
Yeah. I would think so. Wow. My question for you is the space thing. That's from the Superman universe, right?
Yes.
And Kevin actually, early in our relationship, showed me some panels from a comic book edition where one of those dogs gets killed. It gets blown up.
Of course, that's Mammoth Mutt. who leaves behind him the young widow Mammoth Miss.
And he dies saying, yee! And I didn't need to see that.
Obviously, it helped win you over. It was part of my plan.
Never write a book on dating, Kevin. You'll lead a lot of young men astray.
No other man ever showed you panels of the Space Camp Patrol agents.
Yes.
And out of all your suitors, I was the one that won the hand of the fair young Anya.
Yeah, you were fighting an uphill battle after that Space Patrol, Paw Patrol thing.
Space Canine Patrol agents. They're the dog legion.
You should write some sort of FBI story-esque movie about them where it's really boring and gets into all the nitty-gritty of their work in an uninteresting way.
Of course, you know, their enemies are the pet cats of the Kryptonian criminals who were exiled to the Phantom Zone.
Ah, of course.
So that's fascinating battles. You have to admit, a movie about them would have been better than this.
Actually, probably. That's fair.
Probably.
Well, let's...
Probably.
I don't want to see a dog die.
We all meet our maker at some point. It's part of life.
Speaking of that...
What? Oh, yeah. And so, back to this picture. You remember they had a son who joined the Marines.
That ends well.
So, there's a big party, and the family's happy and celebrating, and Jimmy Stewart is singing, and there's a doorbell, and it's the man with a telegram bringing them the tragic news that their son died at Iwo Jima.
Surprise! I mean, it was like, what the fuck are we watching at this point? And, like, listen, like, a lot of young men died in World War II, and it's tragic and upsetting, but... The problem with this movie, again and again, it gives, and I think it actually, weirdly enough, has the same problems in the family scenes as the crime scenes. But basically, like, very serious things are happening. Life-shaking, altering events, whether that's crimes perpetuated by violent and horrible groups, or, you know, personal events that are really heavy in a way. And
I can dig it.
The movie really, I'm glad you can dig it, Kevin.
Well, you said it was heavy.
I'm just telling you.
You're telling it like it
is. I'm telling you like it is. But the movie treats them all sort of with this, like, you know, candy cheesiness of kind of like, oh, what'll happen next? And it's like, but case in point, you know, that scene and like it, none of it feels human. None of it feels real. None of it feels lived in. There's a scene where the wife actually has a miscarriage while Jimmy Stewart is investigating a case, and he comes back and talks with her. And, like, that's a really personal, upsetting, sad situation that, you know, could really, you know, very, very tragic for a couple and, you know, an expecting mother to lose a baby like that. And, you know, they kind of dwell on how serious it is for a minute, but then Jimmy Stewart's like, oh, well, we don't need any more babies. And, you know, that Bible you were looking at and trying to fill our children's name into, that has 24 spaces, so you're never going to have that many babies, so don't worry about it.
You know, to be honest, he makes a good point.
It's like, what the fuck? So a moment that could have been, like, humanizing, or, like, you see how, you know, and all of this, all of these kind of traumatic incidents, whether it's the son's, whether it's the son's death or the miscarriage, or the fight between the couple that leads to the wife leaving, nobody changes, nobody grows. It's just the same thing happening to the same people over and over again, and it's just like they kind of just Teflon, basically. Nothing sticks to them, and that makes it unsatisfying to watch these very serious life events happening, and you don't get a situation where, like, Jimmy Stewart transfers to have a safer job, or that his wife has to just get used to it, or, like, you don't really, nothing's resolved. It's so unsatisfying to watch, because, like, they're actually incidents that could be interesting, but they're just devoid of any sort of, like, impact.
So all this family stuff that we've been discussing, I'd say it's at least 40% of the movie.
Feels like more, but yeah, that's fair.
And it's interspersed. Like, we'll have a crime episode, and then we'll have a family episode, and then we'll have a crime episode. So we've kind of mashed all the family stuff up together.
Viewers can have a little crime stuff as a treat.
And again, there's also a speech he's giving. And
don't you think people are sitting there, like, just shifting uncomfortably in their seats as he's talking about, like, his dead son and his wife's miscarriage and, like,
or his daughter giving a speech and forgetting the words, or the time he had trouble finding enough tissue paper, or the time he had trouble getting the lights on his Christmas tree, or by that time his wife left him. It's like, why is he doing this?
I'm just gonna stand up and be like, I don't want to know this, man. Stop. You don't have to do this in public. I can't even imagine. Those people who left that speech that day were leaving changed peoples. Like, they're not the same fresh faced FBI cadets who came into that building. They are now weary. Maybe this is some sort of weird J. Edgar Hoover mind control tactic. Like, he's gonna get this insane guy to stand up and tell them his life story, and that's gonna harden them somehow, so they'll be able to deal with the worst and most serious crimes.
Before we go into the crimes, I'm curious, what is the worst speech you've either heard or gave?
I gave a really bad speech about, like, Roman history when I was a freshman in college, where, like, I kind of came into it with, like, a weird amount of cockiness for me, because I'm a very anxious person, and normally I'd be like, okay, I need to be ready for this. But this one, I love Roman history, so I was like, we'll wing it. And then that ended up not being such a great idea.
Tell us more.
I've blacked out a lot of it, but it was a group project, and I was way too cocky about it, and I think I made myself look kind of like an idiot in front of everyone in a survey class. So yeah,
I was in a class once where we were supposed to give speeches, and I wrote a speech, and I stood up there and I started giving it, and they were all on the palm of my hands. They were all loving it. You can tell when an audience is with you, and they were with me. And at one point in the speech, I was describing a circumstance where people were doing something that was just primarily to make themselves feel better. It didn't really have any lasting impact other than temporarily making themselves feel better. And so I decided, you know, when I was writing it, I thought, what would be a colorful way to describe that? To bring it alive to these fellow students. And the thing that came to my mind to compare it to was masturbation.
Naturally.
Yes. I'm always talking about masturbation.
Yes, you are. Famous for it.
And so I compare it to masturbation, and all the people in the audience, their faces go pale, the teacher's mouth drops. And I was embarrassed. So that's my worst speech.
It's really three.
It's a pretty good comparison.
What kind of reaction did you think you were going to get?
I thought it was an apt metaphor.
No, I'm going to tell you, the worst speech I've ever sat through that I didn't give, and this is more comparable to, I think, what Jimmy Stewart's doing here. I went to this bougie fucking high school, like, situation, and our graduation ceremony was always bizarrely, I don't know, maybe other schools do this, but, like, the students would speak, like, the class president, blah blah blah, and then, like, a parent elected by the student body would speak, because I guess the parents in my town all have really bad personality disorders, and they, like, need to be involved with every step of their children's lives because they don't have anything of their own. So this is the result of that. And with one of my sisters, when she graduated, I was at the graduation ceremony, and the mom got up there and basically said that, you know, one thing you'll realize when you get to college is, you know, by dint of being from this small New York suburb, you kids are all better than everyone else. And, like, other people grew up in towns with, like, drug overdoses and stuff, but you guys are special, and you won't have to deal with any of that. You're just better than everyone else. So just, you know, be proud of that and definitely lean into it. I remember I was just sitting there like, what the fuck? Overdoses were a problem in my town too. So she was just drinking some sort of Kool-Aid that, you know, I didn't have access to, but it was pretty appalling. But then I looked around and like a bunch of people were like nodding, and it was like, what the fuck is wrong with the place where I come from? So that was definitely like out of body, disassociating, bad of a speech that I sat through. But, you know, I'm from the suburbs of New York, so you get a lot of people with their heads solidly up their asses up there. I was like looking around, like, is anyone else hearing this? Like, is anyone else seeing this happen in front of me? But at least she didn't break down all the best moments of the town or something, because that would have been maybe a little bit more like FBI. But it definitely had an air of psychosis that sort of, I would imagine, Jimmy Stewart's speech would have to have going on this long.
Okay, here's my most awkward speech that I sat through. This is end of eighth grade. It's a school assembly, and I'm sitting next to a friend of mine named Jeff. Jeff is a smart guy, maybe a little nerdy. He's not super popular, but he's smart. He's funny. He's my friend. I'm sitting next. Of course, I, you know, is a big jock type.
What a stud.
Yeah, I deigned to allow this nerd to be my friend. So I'm sitting next to Jeff, and that was basically at my school. I grew up in basically southern Indiana, so I think there was one person of color at my middle school. Maybe I'm exaggerating, but if I am, it's not by much. And so they invited this person, her name was Angela, to come up and give a speech. And she's talking, the theme of her speech is people who don't seem to be really impressive, but have hidden reserves and are really great. And she's like talking about like people in history who like may have been overlooked, but they turned out to be real winners and made a huge difference in life. And so then I guess she wanted to personalize it.
Oh no.
She said, and there's someone who falls into this category here at this school. She said, I'm talking about Jeff.
Oh no.
And she gives his last name. Everybody turns and looks at him. And she says, when you see him walking down the hallway, you just think, boy, this is a big loser. He's just a big nothing. What a nerd. And she goes on and on talking about the bad impression Jeff makes on everyone. And how everybody hates him. But she said, you know, deep down, he's really smart. And he's a winner, too. Good night, everybody.
That'd be funny if she'd lost the last card.
Jeff was so embarrassed and unhappy and angry.
I have a question, like, who was this woman? Or was it another student?
It was another student who's a very good speaker. I think she's, at some point she ran for political office.
And it was on the platform of Jeff fucking sucks. Let's get him out of here. Jesus Christ, that's amazing.
The last time I saw her was after I graduated high school. I enjoy buying old books. And a great place to find old books is to go to thrift stores. And there was a thrift store in town that was some sort of charity for the poor. And so I go there. But they have books. They have books there for a nickel apiece. And so I'm there looking for the books.
And as usual.
And she comes in with some big splashy donation. And she says, oh, Kevin, you know, I think it's so important to give to the poor because it enriches all of us. And it helps all these poor souls here at who go to stores like this.
What?
And then she, like, looks at me and she says, oh. So she thinks I'm down on my luck at the store. And she then quickly excused herself and went away. And that was the last time I saw her. Angela.
She sounds like an asshole.
Yeah, she's given this speech about helping the poor souls at the store in the middle of the
store. Who talks like that? Who talks like that in real life?
Angela.
Jesus Christ. She sounds like nut.
Yeah, I don't think she won her office.
Yeah, I wonder why. Yeah, I'm pontificating like that. Just, no.
But don't you often give speeches in stores?
Yes, I pull up my soapbox, I stand up in the middle of the produce section and start yelling at the top of my lungs.
I guess in fairness, your venue that you prefer is just the Anonymous Manifesto.
Ah, yes, I do much better with that. You know, published in the New York Times, suddenly my family's contacting the FBI.
Which brings us full circle back to this picture.
Interrupting my nice little cabin in the woods. A hot mess.
What's the first crime we cover?
Well, we already got into the bombing of the plane. We pretty much said everything we need to say about that. So I want to start off with, when we talk about the crimes, we talked about the family. I talked about my thesis that the family doesn't, you know, elicit character development or any sort of change with anybody. The crimes are sort of the same thing, you know, and here's an example. In the beginning, there's a throwaway line where Jimmy Stewart's saying, I'm unsatisfied because the boss at the FBI is, he's a political appointee, and I keep telling him that people are being, like, basically enslaved and not able to vote in this Tennessee area, you know, and I'm assuming those are African-Americans, although the movie does not specify that, you know, but I can't do anything about it. And that's just a throwaway line, you know, like, that's a huge injustice, racial injustice, discrimination, persecution going on, and they just kind of treat that as like a ha-ha, he can't do his job. And that's basically the tone the movie takes towards a lot of these crimes. So it can be kind of offensive watching them if you're familiar with the crimes and you know that something horrific happened, and the movie's kind of treating it kind of like, wah, wah, or like, you know, oh, Jimmy Stewart is the central person in this. He's the one who's, you know, this white dude coming from outside dealing with it. He's the one we should be following here.
And we talk about voting rights without mentioning African Americans. We talk about the Ku Klux Klan without mentioning African Americans. Other than a waiter, is there any person of color in this picture?
There's not a single person of color. Well, no, that's not true. There's
a waiter.
There's Native Americans.
Yes.
Yes.
Some people, after we watched this movie, I saw, by the way, that some people believe that the waiter was actually played by a young James Earl Jones.
Was it?
I would have to watch the movie again. We'd have to fast forward to that scene. And I don't want...
that's never happening.
So maybe it's James Earl Jones. Maybe it's not.
It's pretty bad if you're, you know, there's the trend in movies where it's like the white savior plot, right? And that's problematic. But this goes beyond that, because at least in something like a Mississippi Burning, where it is actually about white FBI agents dealing with the situation, at least that names the situation. It's racism. It's the murder of these young, you know, activists, you know, one of whom was an African-American man, two of whom were white. But this is just, it just dances around it. It doesn't even want you, what, you, if you were an alien, you would watch this film and you would have no idea what the Ku Klux Klan was all about. You'd think, I guess they just like dressing up like, you know, in bed sheets. You would come with, they're just generic bad guys in this. They have no point of view. And, you know, and the person you see them attacking in this is for some reason a white newspaper editor. Now, listen, I know the story, before everyone cancels me, I know that they went after white people too sometimes. They didn't like Italians. They didn't like anyone who wasn't Anglo-Saxon Protestant. So I'm not saying that that's not realistic. I'm just saying that, like, when you talk about the history of the KKK, in the USA and like the people they were predominantly going after, you know, at this time, you know, if you're not mentioning African Americans, then you're trying to dance around the issue in a way that doesn't make any sense. But I guess that's what Hoover wanted, right? I mean, that's what it feels like.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess nobody wanted to, you know, like they wanted to be like, the KKK is bad, but we're not really going to get into it too much. You know, they don't want to offend anybody's sensibilities, I guess. That's what it feels like. And you know, and the movie suffers for that. The KKK scene, by the way, Jimmy Stewart has a friend named Sam who was also an FBI agent. You know he's dead from the jump because he's like the, you know, comic relief. And at some point he tells Jimmy Stewart, like, Jimmy Stewart's like, cool off. Like, you take being an FBI agent too seriously. And he's like, that's the difference between me and you. I never want to cool down. Like, okay. But he, at this point, he and Jimmy Stewart actually dress up as KKK people in the hoods and stuff. And they like lock a bunch of KKK people in the truck with their kidnap victim. And they say like, haha, we got you now. And like, that's the end of that. Like, that's also, Jimmy Stewart runs away from his wife who's giving birth to their first child in this scene. So muddling the family and the career stuff really does this picture no good here.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Wasn't his friend Sam present when J. Edgar Hoover was giving his speech?
Yes. So Sam is another kind of interesting aspect of this film that I think with a more competent filmmaker, this character could have done something for me. He starts off, he's just Jimmy Stewart's buddy, and he's definitely the more committed FBI agent.
Definitely.
As a foil to Jimmy, and whose name is Chip, by the way, in this movie. And he is, he's kind of the guy who convinces Jimmy Stewart to stay with the FBI, which was kind of bizarre.
Yeah. He gives this long speech about how basically Jimmy Stewart needs to stay with the FBI because Americans are a bunch of thieving, murderous little bastards, and we need to keep them under control.
Gotta crush them.
Gotta just wipe them out.
Crush them under our shoes.
Firm grip.
Jimmy Stewart's fascist friend, Sam, he's the more gung-ho guy. And then, like, Jimmy Stewart and his wife, you know, he promised his wife that he's going to leave the Bureau, which you could say is unreasonable of her if that's the career he wants. But also, they're a couple, so they're making decisions together. But then Sam interferes and goes on this whole rant in the train in front of them about how Jimmy Stewart needs to stay because Americans suck. And it's just an odd scene. I said, in the scene where Kevin described Hoover, giving this whole big speech about how he's going to clean up the Bureau, going on and on about, how all this stuff is going to change and like, organized crime probably doesn't exist. You know, you just see Sam in the background tearfully jacking off. Because he just gives off that kind of over-exuberant energy. And, he's going to die. I mean, I knew he was going to die when we met him. Because it seems like this is the guy who's going to be an example for, like, how much the FBI, risks for us. They can't kill off Chip. They can't get Jimmy Stewart out of there, so they're going to kill this guy. And they do. Who is he killed by? I called them Pretty Boy Nelson and Babyface Floyd, and Kevin was yelling at me.
I mean, she needs to learn her basic U.S. history.
Baby Boy Floyd.
Babyface Nelson, Pretty Boy Floyd.
Okay, well, he gets...
You need to do some research.
Sorry, Kevin, we can't all grow up in the 30s. Yeah,
Public Enemies by Brian Boroff is a great start.
Pretty Boy Floyd kills this guy after some hijinks, and he dies in Jimmy Stewart's arm talking about, oh, the lilies are coming in or something like that.
We've gotten ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, where are we? This movie. It's so hard to talk about. It just so many, it's like talking about a TV show all at once.
So after the KKK thing, there was some offensive stuff about Native Americans.
Oh, God. Oh, let's talk about that, because I think that's a crime people will be thinking about a lot more recently.
Why is that, Anya?
Killers of the Flower Moon by David Gran is an excellent, 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 beautifully written heartbreaking and just seething book on this case. Basically, Native Americans in Oklahoma inherited oil and mineral rights, land rights, and the land was worthless for a long time, but then oil was discovered, so this land became very valuable, and these people became very wealthy, and basically a cottage industry of white people cropped up around them to scam them, and then later to murder them so that the white people would inherit their land rights. And it was basically like fair to say that Grand's research indicates that it was like a genocide going on in the area. It was that bad. People were getting killed left and right. It's a really disgusting, despicable story that's only recently gotten attention. Like, they're making a movie about it with Leo DiCaprio soon. But it's when you read that book, it's like you're angry, you're sad, you're upset. But this just treats it like it's like a sideshow. You got Jimmy Stewart walking in and being like, these crazy natives, they bought a limo. Ha ha, isn't that weird to see? And it's like, fuck you. It's like, I said it was like watching, it's like a ghoul. Picture a ghoul in your mind. It's a really horrifying creature. It's disgusting. You're looking at it and you're kind of scared and upset. And then this is like somebody tried to put makeup on the ghoul to make it look nice. And you still know it's a ghoul, and it's almost more creepy to see it wearing makeup. And that's how I felt. This portraying this case was just like, it was like, ha ha, these guys are rich, and they like bought a lot of telephones, or they bought a lot of bathtubs. And it's like very judgmental at the victims of the crime. You know, the almost the implication seems to be like, well, what did they think was going to happen if they got rich? And I found that disturbing. And like the FBI did work on that case, but the FBI's role in the case is more complicated because the guy who was actually investigating it for the FBI was an enemy of Hoover's. So they didn't get along. There was a lot of push and pull. It wasn't a straightforward case of the FBI coming in and being heroic. I would argue that there's cases where the FBI has done really good work on it, right? And they kind of just knocked it out of the park. This was not one of them. And I mean, they got some people in the end. But justice was pretty evasive for the people who perpetuated some of these murders.
There was one part of that sequence, though, that I believe you did like. One of the murders was basically a house exploded into nothingness. And then there was a bit of dialogue at that point. Can you reveal that dialogue that you love so much? Classic Richard Breen-ism.
Oh yeah, one of the somebody asked like the local sheriff, is there a reason why you think it's murder, referring to the house explosion? And the guy says, one reason is that there used to be a house here with people living in it. So I thought that was all right. I like a little bit of snappy, sarcastic dialogue here.
Richard Breen's dialogue.
There you go. But, you know, generally I felt like the depiction of this crime, you know, was pretty offensive.
And then after that, we have the story where they go after gangsters and his friend Sam gets killed. I know we already talked about that, but I really want to mention that it had the most almost insulting and offensive funeral scene imaginable, because the minister comes out and says, you know, this guy died. Yeah, I didn't know him, but he was probably a good guy. That's basically the eulogy.
Yeah, that was the eulogy. Like, huh, I didn't even know this dead dude. I guess he was fine. He's probably with God. Who the fuck am I to say?
I hope I get as lovely a eulogy when I go.
And then what's funny is that pretty boy, they established that pretty boy Floyd. Wait, was it pretty boy Floyd? It was Babyface Nelson. One of those assholes. Kevin, you have a thesis on these guys with like the fancy names as they pertain to the FBI. Why didn't you share that?
I don't know if it's my thesis. I think other people have suggested.
Okay, well, a thesis you've spouted at me a few times.
Butterscotch. I think the idea is that a lot of these criminals were basically nobodies, lower class criminals from the Midwest, and the FBI encouraged the proliferation of the use of colorful nicknames for them, so that when they were inevitably taken down by the FBI, it would make it seem like the FBI was really getting mythic figures.
Yeah. And but what's funny about those mythic figures in this is that they kind of just breeze through them, and you have Sam getting murdered by one of them, and then they immediately just bounce to Dillinger. John Dillinger, who is a Hoosier and one of the more, I think you and I can agree, one of the more colorful bank robbers at the time, because he actually had a sense of style. Today he could have been a good bank robbery influencer or something. But he, you know, they jump to him, and it's like we have, you know, the emotional connection is now with the guy who killed your partner, not this other random dude who we were just naming now. And I also would argue that what were you going to say?
No, go ahead.
I would argue that the takedown of Dillinger was not something the FBI should be bragging about.
They breezed through that whole thing.
Dillinger was shot outside a theater coming out.
Biograph Theater, 1934, after having seen Manhattan Melodrama, which starred the young Myrna Loy.
And William Powell.
Clark Gable.
We stand Powell and Gable? Loy. No, and Loy. That's the thin man couple. We love them. But, no, I mean, like, they basically shot a guy when he wasn't expecting it. Is that heroic? Like, you know, like, they just kind of gunned him down in the street. So, would you argue that they basically extrajudicially executed the guy?
I think there's a fair argument to be made that Dillinger was executed, perhaps partially inspired because the FBI was embarrassed over what happened at Little Bohemia. But we can talk about all that another day.
Well, you know, it's just, you know, you see, like, basically what we see as the audience, even if you're not familiar with the Dillinger story, a nerdy-looking man walking out in a
very attractive hat,
in a straw boater, as Kevin said, wearing a straw boater, just like me.
Very dashing hat, a lovely chapeau.
And then he's like, looks at him and is like, oh no, and then gets shot. And it's like, what the fuck? Then you kind of cut through like two other FBI agents dying as they kill Babyface Nelson, and then, you know, they get what was the guy who yelled "Don't shoot me, G-Man"?
Was that Machine Gun Kelly?
Machine Gun Kelly, and that is the weirdest line read in this whole movie. He's like, "Don't shoot me!" Like, he just sounds like he was eating a sandwich before they got him, and then he had to like yell it with his mouth full. It doesn't sound good. And then they have that thing where they caught the guy. He said he was going to kill Hoover, and then they let Hoover arrest him for a PR stunt. It's just like, it's just stupid. We don't need all these arrests. Like this means nothing to it. We haven't seen the FBI agents try to find these people or like investigate the cases. It's just like a montage, basically. My favorite was that they show a shootout with Ma Barker, and like, I'm pretty sure that historians agree that she was just a old lady whose sons were in a robbery gang, and they maligned her post-mortem because they wanted to give an excuse for why they gunned down an old lady. So that's nice. Nice to see Hollywood supporting that.
And then I think there's Pearl Harbor, and then isn't there the South American sequence?
Yeah, they talk about you have Jimmy Stewart. Jimmy Stewart has a bunch of voiceovers in this, and I just want to say, it reminds me of something that I had to look up. But so there's a Bugs Bunny short called "A Hair Grows in Manhattan," where Bugs Bunny starts off in the beginning as a rich guy, and he's got a big mansion in like California, and he's talking about his roots in Brooklyn, New York. And there's a woman who's doing a voiceover in that, narrating all about his like incredible estate in Hollywood. And she's named Lolly. She's supposed to apparently be someone named Luella Parsons, who I guess was some sort of like lifestyle person who would like talk.
She was a gossip columnist.
She's a gossip columnist.
Luella Parsons.
Well, this
had a hopper.
Yes. But in this, it's like a parody of that. But she's basically like, oh, look at the swimming pool and beautiful lawn and, oh, wow, Greek columns. And then basically that's Jimmy Stewart as a voiceover person in this. But just for the FBI, he's like talking about all their wonderful stuff and all the great things they did and like adding pithy comments. And it's just, it's very odd. It's a very odd. It's like suddenly here's Jimmy. He's going to tell us about what the hell's going on. I don't know. Okay, so yeah, now we're in South America. So my understanding was, I don't know, like FBI is like the domestic intelligence agency and they're not like, I don't know, like supposed to go across the sea and do things, but I guess...
Shouldn't this have been the OSS?
Yeah. didn't the CIA exist at this point?
No. The OSS was the forerunner to the CIA. CIA was created, I believe, in 1947. Is that right? By the Office of...
Oh, because we're still in World War II. I forgot.
Yeah, it was the OSS. Office of Strategic Services or something like that.
Listen, when I say United States interference in South America, you know, that doesn't give me a big, fuzzy, patriotic feeling inside. So kind of odd that that's what this movie was trying to go with. Since, you know, a lot of that didn't work so well for people.
So I was kind of nodding off during this sequence. I remember how it ends.
Well, a lot of it's just boring stuff about he's like, I was sent down to, you know, rescue these FBI agents who were down there spying on, you know, various governments and like Nazi activity down there. And the first two guys basically are fine and he just tells them to leave and they leave. The third guy is actually the son of Sam. not the killer, like he's the son of Sam, his FBI friend from earlier.
And he was getting all of his life advice from a dog, right?
Yeah, the dog was his FBI partner, Harvey. Kind of an odd choice. I think you should kill the governor of Paraguay. He'd be out there with a rifle. This is a horrible thing to joke about. I'm so sorry. But basically, he's down there, and he's an FBI agent now, blah, blah, blah. So now Jimmy Stewart's going to go rescue him. He has some transmission center in the jungle, and he's working with a local guy like who's just helping him. You don't really get much background of them. And that guy helps Jimmy Stewart hike up the mountains to meet this kid, George is his name. And the guy's talking, and this was the moment where it clicked for me. The guy says something like, I'd like to see the ocean one day. And I'm like, oh, he's dead. He's going to die. He's going to sacrifice himself for these two American assholes. And that's what happened.
But isn't the sacrifice like really stupid? Like he sets off a bomb and he survives the bomb. And then he stands up and waves his arms, which attracts the attention of snipers, and he gets shot to death. Isn't that what happens?
Yeah, they're fleeing. And
spoiler alert.
They're fleeing, and he blows up a bridge after Jimmy Stewart and George have run to the other side so that he, you know, he's trapped on the other side with the bad guys. And then the two FBI agents are watching helplessly as he gets gunned down. And it was like, all we know about this guy is that he wanted to see the ocean. And then, of course, he falls in a river, and Jimmy Stewart's like, where does that river go? And George is like, I guess to the ocean. And it's like, doesn't add anything. This whole sequence just, it feels incongruent, you know, because this is, you know, I guess maybe at the time this is what the FBI did, but it sort of feels like this isn't really indicative of what the FBI does now because, you know, it's supposed to remain in the United States for the most part. It just, they just really overpacked this.
Speaking of things that don't add anything, there's one more crime sequence. Something about communists. There's a bunch of men in suits walking around, looking at each other. And every once in a while they stop and they call Jimmy Stewart on the phone. And then he calls J. Edgar Hoover. And there's more men walking around in suits. And what's going on there?
They're communists. And they're suit-wearing communists who are at Yankee Stadium in New York. Jimmy Stewart at this point is so advanced that he's not even, like, in the mission. He's leading it from a telephone. So you get a bunch of hot telephone action with him and other people following men in suits. And it's like, at this point, they don't even bother to tell you. Like, all you know is that there's, like, microfilm in a coin that they have to get. It's just a MacGuffin. You don't have any sense of the stakes. You don't know, oh, it's submarine codes. You don't know what the hell it is. It could be the guy's vacation photos for all you know. And so like the level of urgency is just at a zero. I mean, if they're telling us if they get this out of the country, you know, we could be nuked in an hour. Okay, then that's something to worry about. But if it's just like random, they do such a terrible job establishing the stakes, and they're kind of gloating about how, like, you know, oh, you know, he was in a communist group when he was in college. And I think you said something about communist groups in the 1950s.
Oh, a lot of the communist groups in America in the 1950s were basically, basically the only reason they survived was because they got a lot of financial support from the FBI, being, by which I mean undercover FBI agents who joined these groups and paid dues in order to keep an eye on these groups.
So it's basically a man from The Man Who Was Thursday by G.K. Chesterton come to life. And this, you know, there's no Cold War stuff can be really fun and interesting and exciting. This ain't it. And yeah, ugh. And then when you kind of consider the FBI's actual history of like infiltrating leftist groups, it just gets more like, oh, I'm kind of rooting for the fucking communist who just went to see a baseball game. like leave him alone. We don't even know what he's doing.
And that's it, right? He finally finishes the speech. He staggers outside where his family's waiting for him in a car. Presumably they've been waiting for him. And they take a long masturbatory drive by all the DC monuments, stirring music plays. We're done. We're out of here. Am I skipping anything?
No, I think that was pretty much it. I guess for me, Kevin, for you, you know, we talked about that there was maybe a good movie in here. For you, do as much trimming or cutting or mixing that you want to do. Give me the good movie version of this film.
Cut all of the family stuff.
All of it.
Right off the bat.
Nuke it.
Pick one or at most two cases. Follow those in depth. Then you've got a picture.
Yeah, why not, instead of doing specific, like they almost tried to follow the real life crimes too closely. Why not, instead of doing that, pick two crimes, fictionalize them so you can kind of twist the facts to whatever you want. You know, maybe the technology does solve the bombing case. You know, maybe the FBI's letter analysis group does contribute in some way instead of just getting mentioned constantly. Like, make it fit the story you want to tell. And then I would say the key thing would be,
also cut all the training sequences.
Get them out of here. Those rookies have no place in this film. I would say, you know, make Jimmy Stewart's character less Jimmy Stewart, less bumbling, less, oh, shucks, you know, kind of bullshit.
I think cutting the family stuff will largely solve that problem.
Yeah, I actually agree. He's fine when he's at work. You're like, yeah, he's fine. He's doing his job. When he gets home, it's when he's a pain in the ass. That's a good observation. He's fine at work. I thought, like, I mean, this is cliched as all hell, but like, what if he's working with the son of his old partner who died, and it's kind of like hard for him, or like, you know, like you could have a dynamic there where, you know, you could do something with that. But it, as it is, it's just, it's bogged down in every way. I actually think that if you want to give this movie a chance, the best chance you could give it is to do what Kevin did. Watch it in 20 or 30 minute increments. You know, that way you can kind of enjoy what there is to enjoy, because there is some interest around the cases. There definitely is some interest around the cases, but the family stuff bogs it down. In the beginning, when the wife was kind of like, you shouldn't work there, I was like, I don't hate this relationship. They seem to get along. When she told him that she was going to, you know, have a baby, like they had kind of a thing there that I dug. But
when we got married, you made me agree to crush all of my dreams.
Yeah. I mean, we're used to this kind of thing. And you kept talking to me about how great the shrimp was in Indy.
And I also often rave about J. Edgar Hoover.
This guy's got some great ideas. Kevin, he's dead. He's been dead for years. He doesn't talk to you on the phone. This is local scam artist. So, you know, there were some good elements. For me, the real interest in this picture is academic. I think the FBI is a very, very interesting institution. And to me, it's very fun to see how such an institution wants you to view it. And we know that that is how this movie came to be, because J. Edgar Hoover was so involved in the process of creating it. So it's basically the FBI putting out a carefully curated Instagram post to the world to let everybody know that it's thriving, it's well, it's valid. And I think that's kind of fun. They want you to take away that, you know, they're not just G-men. They're not just killers or, you know, Hoover's hired guns or you know, a bunch of nerds and analyzing handwriting. They're also family men. They have sons. They have wives. They have daughters who suck at giving speeches. And, you know, they have feelings, too. And I think there's something very interesting about that. They don't want to look intimidating. They want to look like everyday American Joes who've sacrificed for this great nation.
And they worry about things like tissue paper and Christmas tree lights. They have wives who don't understand them. Gosh, I can relate with that.
Nagging bitch wives. The Kevin Greenlee story. No, I so from an academic, as somebody who's interested in like American history and like, you know, intelligence work and the FBI in general, I think there's something in it held my interest for sure, even though I was baffled by so many of the storytelling decisions.
What's your final take on this thing?
Oh, and I'll also say, for those of you who've watched our previous episode, the ending definitely gives Sherlock Holmes Goes to Washington vibes, just with way better cinematography. Here is the Lincoln Memorial and the George Washington Memorial. At least there was no narration in Churchill quotes. I would say my 5-star final take is that this movie may have been as endless as J. Edgar Hoover's tenure at the Bureau, but its saccharineness and just general cheese make for an occasionally interesting viewing.
Thanks for listening this week. I'd like to give a special thanks to Kevin T. Greenlee, who's no relation to me. He's the guy that composed the great music for this podcast, and you can find him on the web at kevintg.com.
You can follow us on Twitter at MysteryToMe. That's mystery_2_me_. And at MysteryToMe Podcast on Facebook and Instagram.
And you can always send us recommendations and feedback of any kind at mysterytomepodcast@gmail.com.
We're not teens setting up Hotmail accounts in the early 2000s, so all of those spell out 2 as T-O.
Thanks so much for listening.